Thank you. Good evening, everyone. It's good to see a good number out tonight. We trust you'll be encouraged for coming and blessed, and that you'll be able to go away from this place being able to pray a little bit more effectively and intelligently about the work in South Africa and Botswana. But before we do that, we're going to read some verses from the Gospel according to Mark. So, Gospel of Mark, chapter 6. Mark chapter 6, and maybe just before we read that passage, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the background of this chapter is. Mark chapter 6 tells us a little bit about the early ministry of the Lord. And this is near the very beginning when he called his disciples to him, and he sent them out two by two, and he gave them power over unclean wicked spirits, that he had the power to bring them out, and they healed the sick, and they preached the gospel of the kingdom, and they came back to the Lord. They were so excited about the tremendous things they were able to do, and the Lord is a very compassionate individual. He can see the difficulties and challenges of people's lives, and he saw that these men were really exhausted. And in verse 31, it says that he wanted to, he saw them that they were, well, how does it go? He says, and he said unto them, come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much to eat. So much even to eat. So these guys were really, really worked to the bone. And the Lord says, okay, we're going to go to the beach. That's really what he was going to do. He said they're going to have a day at the beach. They're going to relax at the beach and enjoy the Lord's companionship. And so the plan was to go into the boat and to go into the Sea of Galilee. It's a freshwater lake, and I don't know if anybody here has been to visit the Holy Land and been to this particular site. It's a wonderful, wonderful place if you ever get a chance to go there. And they got into the boat and they started to head to an area of the lake where there was going to be a place where they could enjoy each other's company and just be by themselves. Now, as it is, on the lake, you can actually, it's a smaller thing, and you can actually watch the boats as they travel from one place to the other. And they get into the boat. Now, all these people who had been blessed by the Lord and by the disciples, they wanted more. And so they watched the boat. They watched who got into the boat, and they recognized that's the boat the Lord is in, and they followed it. And they just kept walking along the coast, and the Lord was just sort of going fairly close to the board, to the coast. And as the crowd swelled, they went from village to village along, the crowd got bigger and bigger, and a crowd draws a crowd. And by the time the Lord reached the point where he was planned to go, he got out of the boat, and who should be on that side was all these people that the Lord was trying to really escape from, and there they were sitting on that side. And then it says, the Lord, he had compassion on them. He saw them as sheep without a shepherd, and he preached to them. And the day was going, disappearing, and it was getting time to eat. And so you know the story, don't you, about the Lord feeding this large group of people that says there were 5,000 men. So there's probably 10 or 15,000 people there with the women and the children. And he fed them all. And the day is just slowly disappearing. And they didn't really achieve what they had planned. And now the Lord, he says to them, and this is where we're going to pick up the reading. After he's fed them, and they gathered up the fragments. And then in verse 45, this is where we'll start the reading. And straightway, he, that is the Lord, constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he alone on the land. And he saw them toiling in rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh unto them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them. But when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit, and they cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them, and saith unto them, Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And he went up unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased, and they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure, and wondered, for they considered not the wind of the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. And that's all we'll read. We'll stop there. So they were amazed beyond measure and wondered. Now, I want you just for a moment this evening just to think about these disciples in the boat. There was no question at all as to what God's plan was for these disciples. There was no question in the minds of the disciples of what God's will was. It was very clear. The Lord told them, he constrained them to get into the boat and to go to the other side, right? No question. That was the plan. Now, what do you think the disciples thought when they were out in the middle of that lake? And I looked at it this way, in the middle of the sea, in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the night. And they're thinking, why? Why are we in the midst of these difficulties? We were just doing what God told us to do. We were just following the Lord's command. He has control of the weather and the circumstances and the sea. Why is it that he has allowed these difficulties to cross our paths? Why, Lord? We're just doing what you wanted us to do. You know, there's a message that is often proclaimed from many evangelical circles. And the message goes like this. If you become a Christian, you'll be healthy, you're going to be wealthy, and you're going to be happy. Now, that's a message that's preached in many, many circles. I don't see that in the Bible. I don't know if you do. I really wonder where these folks are reading, because it's not in our Bible. And I would challenge anybody who preaches that sort of message to take that message to northern Iraq, to where the Christians there are wondering, are they actually going to live throughout this day? Are they going to actually see their children alive throughout this day with ISIS on the doorstep, ready to slaughter whoever doesn't embrace their radical views? You see, becoming a Christian does not mean that you're going to be healthy. It doesn't mean you're going to be wealthy. It doesn't mean that things are going to come your way. In fact, the Bible teaches the opposite. If you become a Christian, you're most likely going to be involved in a more difficult choice of life. But it'll be a better choice. You're going to be asked to go through difficulties that perhaps you would have escaped had you not become a Christian. So if you're not a Christian here this evening and you think that becoming a Christian, you're going to escape your problems, don't become a Christian. You'll be seriously disappointed. These disciples were just doing what God asked them to do. The Lord sent them. He constrained them to get into the boat and to go to the other side. In the middle of the night, in the middle of the storm, in the middle of these difficulties. And yet the wonderful thing about these fellas is they could have held on to this, that we're also in the middle of God's will. Now that's the wonderful thing for the Christian, is that when they have been called to go through something, when they go into a different challenge and they are convinced that the Lord has called them, they can face the difficulties that cross their paths because they understand this is where God wants me to be. Now, obviously, you might be able to make the connection between my own experience or my wife and myself experience and serving the Lord on the mission field. Many of you have asked today why I have this problem with my legs. And let me just tell you very briefly the background of what has taken place. In November of 1991, my wife and I were commended by Shore Acres Bible Chapel in Burlington to go to Botswana to serve the Lord. And we went to the capital city called Habaroni, where we joined with Dr. Clark and Hazel Logan, who are from Northern Ireland, who had been serving the Lord already for 10 years there. And we had joined with them to learn the language and the culture and to start to work with the gospel. And within 6 months arriving in the country, we had, initially we rented a house in the suburbs of Habaroni. And in the apartheid days, the houses were designed to have, they had your regular house where the family lived, and then they had what they call servants' quarters that were small one-room dwellings at the back of the house, at the back of the plot. And that's where the gardener would live, and that's where the maid would live, and any other domestic help. They would live in these one-room quarters. Now, when we rented our house, it had these little domestic dwellings at the back, and the landlady had rented those out to some poorer people who could only afford a one-room thing, and they were living in the back. Now, I got sick with some sort of a sinus infection and a flu, and I was laid up in bed, and in African culture, it's very important that you visit people when they're sick. There's a bit of superstition behind that as well. And one of the men who was living in one of these servants' quarters, he came into my room and he wanted to visit with me. And he didn't know it at the time, but he had active tuberculosis. And during the course of our visit, somehow through him coughing, or I'm not sure what it was, but the TB bacilli passed from him to myself. And it went, instead of entering my lungs and becoming pulmonary tuberculosis, which is normally how it's presented, it went into my sinuses, which were infected, and then passed into the meninges of the brain. The meninges is the lining around your brain and your spinal cord. And so within a short period of time, I became desperately ill with this disease. Nobody seemed to know what it was, but it created all sorts of serious, serious pain in my legs. Now, my wife is a nurse, and at that time in Botswana, you didn't need a prescription to get medication. You just went to the chemist and described your problem, and he would give you drugs right over the counter. Didn't matter what drugs it was, he'd give it to you. And my wife went and explained the situation, and they gave me as many painkillers as they felt that they could give me, and it just did not touch the pain. The pain was just unbearable. And I remember at this point, we had no power in our house, and I had installed a propane water heater in the house so that we could at least have warm water for showers and baths. And that night, it was about 3 in the morning, and I was in such severe pain, I didn't know what to do to get this pain. And I did notice that if my wife put warm hot water bottles on my legs, that made the pain go away a bit. So I said, "Karen, you're going to have to do something. The pain is beyond what I can take." And I asked her to run the bath for me. So we had, in those days, we did not have power, so Karen lit these paraffin lamps, or kerosene, what do you call them, hurricane lamps. That's what we used there. And she lit those around the house, and then she ran the bath, and I sat in the tub, and it just, the pain started to go away, and it just felt so good. But as soon as the water started to cool off, the pain came back with even greater vengeance than even before. And I said, "Karen, you're going to have to call Clark Logan." Now, Clark's a doctor, but he's a gynecologist. But at that time, I wasn't fussy. I'll take anybody. And she called him and said, "Listen, would you come over and see Sid? He is really, really sick." And so he had seen me earlier in the day, but I wasn't as bad as I was at this point. And he was starting to come over, and Karen said, "Listen, Sid, let's get you out of the tub. We've got to get you back into the bed." And so I tried to start to move to get out of the tub, and that was the first time I discovered that I couldn't move my legs anymore. They were completely paralyzed. And so Karen had taken a towel and laid it on the floor beside the tub, and I worked myself up with my arms to get onto the edge of the tub, and I fell onto the towel, and I pushed with my hands, and my wife pulled with the the towel and dragged me into the bedroom. And I don't know how I got into the bed, but I did get in there somehow. And that was the last I remember. I fell and I was unconscious after that. Clark had arrived with his wife, and they took one look at me and said, "We got to take him to the hospital." So they put me in the back of the pickup truck, and they took me to the private hospital, and they tried to save my life with everything that they could do. But they could see that there was something going on inside the brain that they couldn't figure out, and they didn't have an MRI machine. They did not have a CAT scan machine in the country whatsoever. And in order for them to find further investigations, they needed to send me somewhere else. So the only place was to go to Johannesburg in South Africa. Now, South Africa in that time was still in apartheid, and Canadians weren't welcome in South Africa. We had to have a special emergency visa to be organized for us to get into the country. And so that was done, and our three little boys that were with us, they were sort of shipped off to different Christian homes in the country, in Botswana. And then Karen and myself and a colleague were flown from Habaroni to Johannesburg. And I still to this day don't remember anything of that hospital or that flight. We arrived in Johannesburg, and the doctors tried to save my life. They put me through the MRI, the CAT scan, and they had all sorts of crazy ideas of what was going on, and my body was just starting to shut down. And they were at the stage where they're going to put a tracheotomy in because my lungs were about to shut down. And one of the neurologists, he said this. He said, "Listen, let's try and treat him with TB drugs. And just on the off chance, it might be TB meningitis. And there's no way of proving that because it takes 2 or 3 weeks for the test to be properly done." So they started to treat me with TB drugs, and within a day or two, I started to respond, and I woke up, and I discovered that I'd never been sick before in my life. I'd never spent a day in the hospital before, and now I had tubes coming in and out of me. I had lost over 45 pounds in that short period of time from just off my legs, and I tried to feel my legs, and I couldn't. I felt them, but my legs didn't feel. I couldn't feel my legs, and I couldn't move them. And so the doctors finally came in once I was awake, and they said, "Sid, we're going to have to do the pinprick test," is what they called it. And they wanted to see at what level the injury was on your spinal cord. And what they did is they said, "We're going to take a pin, and we're just going to poke you, start at your toe, and we're going to work our way up the leg until you feel it. And you tell us when you feel it." And so they started to poke me, and I was surprised to see them touching me and seeing the skin actually being depressed, but me not feeling it. And they worked their way up my leg, and I never felt anything until they reached this part of my abdomen. And so that helped them to understand where the injury in the spinal cord was. So there I was. 6 months on the mission field, paralyzed. Now what do we do? In the middle of the night, in the middle of the storm, in the middle of the sea. But I knew I was in the middle of God's will. I knew the Lord had called us there. And I couldn't explain why these difficulties were about to cross our paths. But I knew that what we were doing, this was the right thing. And I didn't understand the details or the circumstances of why these difficulties crossed my path. But I did know that God still had a plan. So our colleagues came down from Botswana and they said, "Sid, if you'll let us, we'll take you back to Canada." And we eventually, through some prayer and direction from the Lord, it was clear that that's what we needed to do. So we were air ambulanced from Johannesburg back to Toronto. And the ambulance met us at the airplane, and they took us right away to Mississauga General Hospital. And there was a little Jewish neurologist who had never seen a living specimen of TB meningitis before. And he was thrilled to death that I was going to be wheeled into his hospital. I'm glad somebody was happy. So we arrived at Mississauga General, and we had 7 weeks of going through the whole gamut of tests again. And they wanted to demonstrate that this was truly what it was. And I was tested for AIDS and all sorts of other things several times over. And it was clear that I had TB meningitis. Now, when we first arrived in Mississauga General, I was put in isolation. And no visitors were allowed. It was just the doctor and the nurse that was allowed to see me. And they were gowned up head and toe. And I had my own special nurse. And she did everything for me. And at this time, I was paralyzed seriously. My bladder, bowels, everything was dysfunctional. So all of those details had to be attended to. And finally, this lovely nurse, the isolation had come off, and I was now able to receive visitors. Now, this lady didn't know me very much, but she knew I was a Christian. She knew I was a missionary. And we developed a friendship. And as soon as isolation was removed, the whole Golden Horseshoe, the believers, had been praying for us. You folks had been praying for us here, too. Some of you would remember those days. And we started to receive visitors. And literally, there was a lineup outside our door all the way down the hallway of visitors wanting to come and see us. And my nurse kept wanting to come in to give me meds or do something or bathe me. And every time there was another person there. And finally she said, "Hold it." And she stopped the line, kicked everybody out, and came in, closed the door, and looked at me right in the face and says, "Who are you?" And I was just so happy to just tell her that I'm a child of God and these are my brothers and sisters. And it was a great testimony to her, as to many in the hospital, of the love and the care that we received from the believers. So to make a long story short, we spent 7 weeks at Mississauga General. Then we spent 3 months at Lyndhurst Rehabilitation Center in Toronto, where we were taught to walk again. And I remember the very first session in that rehab center. I was on the gymnasium on the floor, on a mat. And my physiotherapist was trying to teach me how to crawl again like a baby. All right? Now just get this. I'm on my hands and knees trying to learn how to crawl again like a baby. And I'm thinking to myself, it was just a few months ago I was in Botswana serving the Lord on the mission field, preaching the gospel to people with great ambitions. And here I am in Toronto trying to learn how to crawl again. And it just hit me. And I said, "God, why? Why?" And I started to just to weep, looking for an answer. And I asked the lady if she could just leave me for a little while. And I just prayed and wept as I began to find out, "Lord, why is this happening?" And at that very moment, there were two verses in the book of Philippians that popped into my head. And they were verses like this. "He which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ." And being confident of this very thing, that he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. And what really hit me in that verse is working in me. He that worketh in me. And the preposition that really was driven home to me is the preposition in, that God was working in me. And you know what? For the very first time in my young missionary experience that I began to understand, you see, I was so excited. What is God going to do through me? I'm going to go out there and see people saved. I want to see assemblies established. I want to serve the Lord. I want to be a blessing to other people. And for the first time, I began to understand something really important, that God was far more interested in the work that he'll do in me than ever the work he'll ever do through me. And so that was the beginning of what I began to understand as the reason for some of these challenges that cross our paths. You see, God has a model that he wants for me. And in order for me to arrive at that stage in my life, where I can be the person that Christ wants me to be, I need to go through challenges. I need to go through difficulties. And I want to encourage each and every one here this evening. You know what? God has a plan. Thank God for that. And difficulties are going to cross your path. They're going to be there. It's absolutely there. But we as believers can lay hold on this wonderful thing that God is absolutely in control. And there will nothing cross your path and my path that will not, first of all, cross the desk of God before it ever enters our life. He has approved it. He has sanctioned these difficulties, and they're there for your blessing and for your learning and for the blessing of others, of God's people. Well, that was a great revelation to me. So anyways, we spent 3 months in that hospital, and then we had 12 months of physiotherapy from 9 o'clock till noon every day for a year. And after 18 months of this entire thing, I was able to start walking again. And so we went back to Botswana. And we arrived again in the capital city, and we continued for another 6 months in the capital city of Habaroni. And then we had desired to go into a new area and start to serve the Lord as a pioneer missionary. So we spotted this village up in the northern part of the country called Maun. And that village there is the tribal capital of the Batawana tribe. And we moved up there. We bought a piece of land in the middle of the village. And we had our three boys with us. And, you know, all of our three boys, we asked them before we left Canada, what is the one toy that you want to bring with you when you go back, when you go to Botswana? And all three of them said, we want to bring our Tonka trucks. So they brought their Tonka trucks. And so we bought this piece of land. And here we are in the middle of the village. And we are... We started to dig our trenches, and so there's a big pile of dirt, okay? And you can't keep little boys away from a big pile of dirt when they got their Tonka trucks, eh? And so there's these three little guys, white kids, playing with their Tonka trucks, and 20 little African boys in a circle around them can hardly wait to play with these toys as well. And so we looked at, Karen and I looked at each other and thought, great, this is the start of our Sunday school. And so we started just speaking to these young kids, to these children. And we invited their parents, and we had some of the older ones, and some of our workers were coming. And so under the shade of a mopani tree in our backyard, we continued with gospel work with these young people. And it was amazing just to see how the Lord blessed His word. And even to this day, seeds that were sown 20 years ago or 15 years ago or 10 years ago are producing fruit today. This young lady here, her name is Omulemo. This picture was taken probably about 10 years ago. 3 months ago, Omulemo trusted the Lord. She was a Sunday school child of my wife's class, and she's been baptized and now in the assembly. This is fruit that is taking place many years after. And so it was a tremendous opportunity just to work in Maun with the children and to see them saved and baptized and come into the assembly. You know what? We found that we had far greater success with young people than we had with the older ones. The older ones were still steeped in their witchcraft and in their immorality, that they were a great disappointment. But we thought, let's get to the young folk. And today, there are 6 assemblies in Botswana, and all 6 of them are led by elders who were saved in the Sunday school. That's the result of the work. And so all of the work was really basically as a result of children's work. Now, I'm just going to skip through some of these slides because I took a bit longer in my opening remarks. But some of the things that we like to do in our gospel work in Botswana that works very effectively is tent work. And so we would set up a tent in the middle of the village anywhere. We would just go anywhere. We would check with the chief in that area and see if he agreed, and they always do. And so we set up a tent. And in Setswana, this is our name in Setswana, in Ploya Ifangheli. And, of course, the children think the circus has arrived, you know. And you know, in many ways, a lot of these African kids have never seen a white person before. And they find this very interesting for some reason. And, you know, I've been driving my 4x4 through the bush, and a little kid will come running up to the track, and he'll point at me, and he'll go, Lakoa! And Lakoa means white man. And the way he says it is, look, everybody, a giraffe. That's the sort of the tone behind his expression. But just think about it. Where else in the world can you set up a gospel tent like this in the middle of a village And at 5 o'clock in the evening, you go around with a handful of people and some gospel papers and invitations, and you say, listen, we've got gospel meetings coming up in this tent just over here, and you're welcome to come. And you know, by 7 o'clock that evening, you have 300 people have come to listen to the gospel in the tent. You know, I don't understand, if anybody likes to preach the gospel, what on earth are you doing here? I mean, I preach to more unsaved people in one Sunday in Botswana than a whole year of preaching at family Bible hours in Canada. I mean, that's where the fish are biting, on that side of the world. You've had your chance over here in Canada. And so here we are preaching the gospel. Now, after a gospel campaign like this, there's always 50 or 60 kids that say, listen, can we come to your Sunday school? We want to come and listen to this again. And so I says, okay, well, let's meet here on a Sunday morning at 8 o'clock, and I'll pick you up, and we'll take you to the chapel. So I get there, and there's, you know, all these kids, so I pack them in as tight as I can. I get about 25 kids in the truck at one time. I have to do 3 loads, and I'm thinking, oh, I can do better than this. So I get a bigger truck. And so I ended up with 2 flatbed trucks like this. I can get about 65 kids in one load, and we take them, and they're singing all the way through the village, all the way to the chapel where we have our meeting. So there we are. And again, I'm just going to skim through some of these things here. I know I've told a story before about how the Lord blessed us with finances in order to build our building, but this was our chapel that we initially built, and as time progressed, we decided we would really like to see a proper building for our believers, and so the word got out, and I remember one of our furloughs, there was a man, he asked me, he says, so how much do you think it would cost, he said to me, to get that building up to roof level that you're wanting to build, And I really wasn't prepared for the answer. I just took the number out of the hat. I says, oh, maybe $25,000 U.S. And he says, oh, yeah, I can afford that. And he wrote me a check for $25,000. And I thought, why didn't I ask for $50,000? Because we needed it in the end. But anyways, we started building, and the building started to come together, and it was really exciting just to see that. And it was a great testimony to the believers as well, because they were asking me, why are Christians from Canada sending money so that we can build a church building here and they'll never ever use it? You know, that was a good question. And it was a good lesson for them to learn about the value of the body of Christ and how each of us have a responsibility to share with others. And so the building started to come together, and like a good Canadian, I think big. And so that was the building that we built there. We can seat 500 people in that building. And I built that for $85,000. And I don't think you could do that over here. So we had hosted the national conference there, Easter conference, and this was how it looked like in the building. So we spent 20 years in Maun, and the last 10 years, even though I initially recovered very well from TB meningitis, I could walk as good as you guys could initially after I recovered, and I could walk that way for 10 years. And then the last 10 years, I started to go downhill, and I began to trip on my right leg, and I'd fall, and so I started using a walking stick, and then eventually I had to use 2 walking sticks, and then eventually 2 crutches. And we began to realize that, listen, my days in this African bush are coming to an end. We're going to need to make a change. And there's always a question as to how long a missionary should stay. And it was pretty clear that the Lord was indicating we need to make a move. So the options were this: come back to Canada, or move to South Africa, because South Africa has great medical facilities, and there's plenty of gospel work that can be done down there. And so our last Sunday at the assembly, this was the photo that we took, and we left the believers. This was in August of 3 years ago, and we left the believers with 25 believers in fellowship and 200 kids in the Sunday school, and a lovely building, 2 flatbed trucks. And I was talking to one of the elders a couple of months ago, and I said, "Dan, how's the assembly going, and how many are in fellowship now?" And he said, "Well, we can thank the Lord. We have 33 believers now in fellowship." And he says, "You know what, Sid? We have 600 kids in the Sunday school." And I thought, well, how did that happen? He says, "I don't know. They just started to come. It was as a result of the gospel meetings in the tents." And he says, "But we got a problem," he said. "The government has stopped us using the flatbed trucks to transport the kids. And they want us to use buses, and we can't afford buses." And he says, "So what we have now is we've got 400 children will walk the 5 kilometers to the chapel, and we have a Sunday school there. And then we have another 200 kids that meet we've rented a piece of land 10 kilometers from the chapel, and that's where they're meeting now at the same time as the satellite Sunday school. So we're wanting to buy that piece of land. That's what we're looking at now, and we're just investigating that. We can buy it at a fairly reasonable price. So that's something that we're looking at in the future, well, getting that piece of land and having a satellite work to the gospel work in Mao. So I'm going to leave that there for you, and we're going to leave Botswana. Before we leave Botswana, let's do a little safari, okay? If you come to Botswana, I will take you into the bush. And we had a young lady come. Her name was Tara. And she was actually the lady who had drafted the plans for our chapel there. And we went up in the Okavango, and I said to her, "Are you a brave girl?" She says, "Yes." And I said, "Good. You stand up in front of that boat, stand on the bow." And we caught a small tiger fish. And I asked her just to hold it up nice and high and just watch what happens. Now, I don't know if you can see this. You know, I'll try and get my cursor to work. Doesn't seem to want to work. Anyways, just right there is a white dot. That's a fish eagle. And he sees Tara holding up that fish. Now watch where that white dot goes. And Tara now is starting to get terrified because she's, you can see her hand has come up to her chin. She can't believe what she got herself into. Her knees start to buckle. And all of a sudden, she starts to see this huge fish eagle. This is a big bird. And he is now stalling in front of her to slow down to grab this fish. And he took that fish right out of her hand. And that's pretty awesome photography, if I do say so myself. And there's the fish eagle just enjoying that fish. I could spend all day here showing you slides of game in Botswana. It's one of the most prettiest places in the world for safaris and things like that. So here we are now. We've moved to Cape Town. And I'm going to have to fly through this because we've only got about 6 minutes left. So Cape Town is a completely different situation, aren't we? We've gone from the desert bush to a huge metropolis right in the coast of, between two oceans, the Indian and the Atlantic Ocean. Now, the population of Cape Town is 4 million people. With the suburbs, you're looking at 8 million. 24% of unemployment. And that's just the official stats, okay? And even the 8 million, that's just official. We have millions of other Africans who have come down to the Cape Peninsula looking for a better life, looking for better work. We're talking about people from Zimbabwe, from Mozambique, from Malawi, Angola, Kenya, and Nigeria. And all of these places they've left. A lot of these places have left and come to the Cape Peninsula. And that has added a tremendous strain again. HIV, 19%. Look at that. Living on less than a dollar a day, over 35% of that 8 million are living on less than a dollar a day. Can you imagine the desperate poverty? We live in Cape Town. We live in a very upmarket white area of the city. It's a very safe area, and we've had some really nasty, unsafe situations that have happened in Botswana. And I made it very, very sure that moving to Cape Town, I was going to keep my family safe, and so we went into this secured area. But within a 10-minute drive, we can be going from the first world into the third world in some of the most desperate situations. So Afrikaans is the language of choice there. So we are learning Afrikaans now. Now, this is a picture I wanted to show you of just some of the difficulties that people live in. With living on less than a dollar a day, this is the type of housing that people have found. And they just will, these are undesignated settlements, squatter camps. They just pop up out of nowhere. And people will start to build a house out of cardboard or a wooden pallet and then a corrugated iron. And look at this, as far as the eye can see, that's what this settlement is. And there are thousands of people in these places, and there are dozens of these settlements. And these settlements are seriously dangerous places to be at. The cops won't even go in there. It's run by gangsters. It's drugs and prostitution and all sorts of crime is rampant in these places. And so a very, very dangerous area. A white guy like me could not just walk through that place. I wouldn't make it to the other end. And so there are different ministries that are on the peripheral that various people have been working in. Now, I mentioned Afrikaans as part of our language, and we started to take Afrikaans lessons. And when we came to Hebron, we had a choice of a number of assemblies in Cape Town. You might be surprised to hear that there are 30 assemblies right in Cape Town. And then there's another 30 assemblies within a two-hour drive from the center of Cape Town. Now, in the old days, the assemblies were divided by the apartheid rules. You had your white assemblies, your colored assemblies, and your black assemblies. And this was formerly a white assembly. It's no longer that now. It's a mixed of coloreds and whites. Now, when I refer to colored people, I'm not referring to black people, okay? Blacks are a different entity in South Africa. But coloreds are people who are, by their definition, are of a mixed race. So they are usually people made up of part Indian, part white, and part African. And they have their own culture. They have their own way of doing things. They have adopted the Afrikaans language for the most part. And they're very, very nice people. They're great people. And I didn't realize it till we got to South Africa that I'm actually in a mixed marriage because my wife is Mohawk, and she's Mohawk Indian. And to them, she's considered to be a colored. And she looks actually very much like most of the colored folk there, and the same skin color. And I remember I was speaking at a colored conference, and actually I wasn't speaking; I was just attending it. And one of the conveners came up to me and he said, "You know, I admire you." And I thought, "Oh boy, this will be good. I'm going to hear this one." And I says, "Why is that?" I was hoping for some really spiritual reason, but. He says, "You know why? Because you married out of your race. You married a colored girl, and that was why I was high in his estimation." Oh well, okay, whatever. And so, anyways, we started to learn Afrikaans, and the elders at this assembly have asked us, "What do you think we should do in the way of gospel work?" And so they were at a bit of a crisis in their own assembly. They were looking for some help, and so we. Somebody who's from Holland here, I'm sure you can read that a little bit and understand it, yeah? So Afrikaans is really from a Dutch background. So what we did is we translated the seed sower text into Afrikaans, and we decided to have, I suggested to the brethren, let's use our parking lot as a car wash. Let's hold a week of gospel meetings, but the Saturday before the gospel meetings, let's have a car wash. And we'll have a braai. Now, what's a braai? A braai is a South African barbecue. And we're going to give away free boerewors. Now, what's a boerewor? A boerewor is like your hot dog, but 10 times better. And this is part of their culture as well, the boerewors. So we got our young people out on the street and waving people to come in and get their cars washed for free. And we had the Afrikaners, the white folk, coming in and said, And as soon as they walk into the place, they say, all right, what's the catch? What's the catch? We know nothing's for free in Africa. What are we selling? And we say, listen, we're just here to give you an invitation to attend gospel meetings this week. And we're going to wash your car. We want to give you a free bourgeois. We got some literature here. We just want to meet you and just chat with you. And they were very impressed with that. And everybody got involved in the car wash. And, of course, there's the braai going with the bourgeois, and the smoke is going up, and right away that smoke is just start to filter out the neighborhood, and everybody can smell that, and they just start coming. And there's the ladies getting ready. And also one of our brethren had a race car. And I says, no, bring that race car, park it right in front of the chapel. And I don't know if you know what these type of race cars. This is called an Ariel Atom. And this is the fastest car on the planet. I'm not kidding. It's Lamborghinis. Bye-bye. We're way ahead of them. This thing goes 0 to 100 kilometers in 2.5 seconds. It runs on jet fuel. And it's like a rocket on a skateboard. It's the fastest thing. And as soon as we put that out, this is like Canada Cruisers, Cape Town style. And so that brought a lot of guys out, wanted to look at that thing. And, of course, it was a great opportunity to give out gospel literature. And, of course, I got a chance to ride in the race car. Believe it or not, it's street legal in Cape Town. Wouldn't be here, but over there it is. So these are different ways in which we've been able to reach out into the community. We did the same thing, gospel meetings like this in another area, in another town. We took our young people there. And it was a great opportunity to expand and to encourage other believers and that our time is gone, so I'm just going to quickly go through these prayer requests. Three prayer requests. I'm going to ask you to pray for the Maun Assembly. And there's two local elders there, two African brethren. Pray that the Lord continues to bless the work. And these fellows are very active in gospel work. And that piece of land that we'd like to purchase, we just ask you to pray about that as well. And just pray for the growth of that assembly. My health as well. Maybe just take 2 minutes, if you'll just forgive me for going over a little bit here, but let me tell you what an update is on my health. A lot of the questions the doctors have been asking, why is it that you have gone back downhill? And the doctors have, they have monitored a Cerix on my spine. It's a sac of fluid that's been on my spine since the initial meningitis. And that sac of fluid has not changed and altered. If it had, that would have been a problem. But they've been monitoring it with an MRI every 2 years. And in fact, they said, listen, it hasn't changed in this period of time. It won't. It's not going to change. So there's no problem there. Why is it that you're getting worse? And they can't figure it out. And there's no further neurological reasons why I've gone downhill. So last October, I was in Botswana having gospel meetings. And during that period of time, I had a bladder infection. And I went to the doctor, and I got a medication that I'd used the last 10 or 12 years. And it's a powerful antibiotic. Some of you may have heard of it. It's called Cipro. And it's one that I've used for the last 10 or 12 years. It always does the job. It cleans up the bacteria. And I'm on my way. Now, that particular time, when I took the Cipro, I could tell right away that my lots of pins and needles in my legs, there was a lot of irritation in my legs, a lot of weakness, and muscle cramping and spasms. And I thought, wow, this is so weird to have this bad response from Cipro. So I carried with the medication, finished it, and I got back to Cape Town. And I went to my doctor there. She's a surgeon, but she's also a homeopath. And she asked me, so what was the medication that they gave you in Botswana? And I said, it was called Cipro. And right away she says, oh, no. She dropped her head and says, that is a seriously, seriously bad drug. She says, last month, referring to September last year, the FDA had forced Bayer to put a special warning on the box. And the warning stated this. The use of this medication can cause irreversible neurological side effects. And that was the thing, the new thing that they put on that box. And she said, how long have you been taking this? I says, I've been taking it off and on for 12 years. And then she thought, this is starting to make sense. You see, that she thinks that this antibiotic that I've been taking for 10 or 12 years has somehow affected me in a very bad way neurologically. And she says, so that's the theory that we're working on now. There is a detox that I'm on right now to remove the neurotoxins. And there is some indication that this might be working. So I'm just going to ask you to pray in that regard, okay, for my health. I mean, I don't mind the wheelchair. I don't mind the walking sticks. I would just love to have a little bit more strength, a little bit more mobility to be able to get around and do the work that the Lord has placed in our hearts. And then I ask you just to pray about the future focus of our ministry. I mean, we're used to having one assembly being our focus and seeing this is our baby, and I don't mean in the wrong sense, but this was something that we were able to see from the ground up to develop to what it is. And now we are actually in Cape Town where there's all these developed assemblies already, and I'm doing a bit of itinerant preaching and teaching, and that's okay. But I'm a pioneer and I'm an evangelist, and I would love to see a new work started, but I'm bothered by my legs and I don't have the strength to do what I would like to do. So I'm asking you just to pray for Karen and I that we might know the Lord's leading in these things. Now, I'm going to just close with this. There's a table set at the back with new prayer cards, and there's also a list there. If you want to receive an email from us, this is supposed to be a quarterly newsletter that I actually turn it into an annual thing. So that's how often I get this done. If you want to receive it, whenever I get it done, put your email address down there, and then I'll make sure we send that to you. Dan, would you mind closing in prayer, brother? I'm just going to close the meeting. Thank you very much. Sorry for going over time.